This is an ABC podcast.
Yandra Nisambola, I'm Evan Wasuka, and this is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Coming up on today's show, we'll take a look around the region on how Pacific countries are paying tribute to Pope Francis.
I love this Pope so much. He's very special to my heart for plenty of reasons.
You see that my place, ECPIC personally, a remote place, for me it's something significant, and it's like a father who cares for his children.
He emphasized what he always preached, or what he always talked about. He brought all those to PNG.
And we'll hear how the Fijiana Drua, that's the women's team, will be front and center in an upcoming Super Rugby showcase. And...
But I still thought it was a prank. I thought it was a joke. And then he kept saying, no, it's not. And he was serious. And so that was a bit of a surprise. And it was amazing. It was just overwhelming. I still thought it was a joke for a couple of days later.
It wasn't a joke. In fact, it was a nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize. We'll meet the man who's been nominated, Samoan Lele Le'laulu. That's all coming up on Pacific Beat, broadcasting to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation, otherwise known as Melbourne. But first, locals on Tinian in the Northern Marianas are demanding answers from the US military around a project to revive a World War II airfield on the island. The airfield was once used as the staging point to launch the B-29 planes to drop atomic bombs on Japan. And locals are worried if nuclear contamination may exist beneath the undergrowth. Kyle Evans with more.
Tinian in the Northern Marianas. It's known for pristine waters, hot peppers, and archaeological relics. What people don't know is the dark role it played during the Second World War. Tinian was a strategic location used to drop atomic bombs on Japan. The two infamous bombers which carried the bombs, Enola Gay and Boxcar, took off from runways on the island. And locals haven't forgotten.
Since the late 60s, students from Hiroshima and Nagasaki would come to Tinian on the anniversary of those two events.
Juanina Mendiola is the interim chief executive of the Tinian Women's Association. She fears history could repeat itself thanks to a major US rehabilitation project aimed at bringing the airfield back to life. She worries excavation work currently being carried out at the site might disturb areas once exposed to nuclear weapons, potentially placing locals at risk.
When you're talking about the North Field rehabilitation, are you talking about rehabilitating the nuclear part of it where they took where they stored the nuclear weapons and took off with Enola Gay? So we have no idea to what extent they're trying to rehabilitate.
An environmental impact study of the project states the airfield will be used to support cargo planes, tankers, military exercises, and humanitarian relief. However, Ms. Mendiola says detail about how the work is being carried out is lacking. But nuclear experts aren't too concerned about nuclear hazards. Here's Tilman Ruff, an honorary principal fellow in population and global health at the University of Melbourne.
They were there for a short time in fairly advanced form. You know, these were not sort of early liquids or anything that needed further processing. These were the finished sort of manufactured components. So the area involved, if there was residual contamination, would be quite limited.
What does concern him is the contamination caused by other chemicals and materials from the time period.
This was a massive airfield. So this was not just big, but would have been incredibly busy. And there would have been an awful lot of industrial work, construction activities. Very many of these large military air bases are very dirty, contaminated sites. And in all of these operations, public health and environmental protection is, you know, the bottom of the list. So I would expect that with there must be a whole bunch of residual chemical contaminations from those times, potentially leftover ordnance over such a large site that's been overgrown and covered with vegetation, and, you know, whatever infrastructure is there would have been degraded.
This isn't a new issue for the Northern Marianas. Saipan-based lawyer and cultural anthropologist Issa Ariola said in the years since the war, there's been a pattern of environmental regulations being circumvented to complete projects. But what worries her more is what the revival of the airfield means more broadly.
The work that's being done on Tinian right now by the military is being called Tinian Divert Infrastructure Improvements. And so it's being couched in this kind of rhetoric of infrastructural improvements on the airport, et cetera. But what we're seeing is in a really intense, like, remilitarization, reusing of the same runway that they did back in World War II, right? And we're finding ourselves asking that same question of what is our role? How are we being used in this kind of overall project that's happening here? It's also not entirely clear what the actual threat is, because we see a lot of this in the media about, you know, there's a lot of scary words being thrown out there about China, right? And so I think this is also an important question that's coming up, is can we put their spending in context? What is actually the level of threat that we're experiencing?
Director at the Guam-based think tank, the Pacific Center for Island Security, Leland Bettis, says there's also a doctrine element to the process, aimed at deterring would-be adversaries to the US. He says the airfield gives the US another chess piece in the event Guam is incapacitated during a conflict.
It's really about creating this, I think, this notion that you've got to, if you want to take us on, you've got a lot of airfields to take out.
This too is a concern for Tinian locals, who fear their home could also be in the crosshairs if geopolitical tensions with China were to one day spill over.
It's just like they took a red ink and marked us right there. And, you know, we used to not be able to be seen on the map, on the world map, because we're such a tiny speck. Now with the activities of the military, that whole entire stretch of islands all the way across Micronesia, we're going to be a big target.
That's Juanita Mendiola, Interim Chief Executive of the Tinian Women's Association. And that report was by Kyle Evans.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to rugby, and everything in between. Fresh Off the Field, Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. PNG time on Radio Australia.
This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Evan Wasuka. And as the world's attention turns to Pope Francis's burial this weekend, the big question on many people's mind is on who will replace the Argentinian. That decision rests in the hands of the Catholic cardinals who will be in the conclave at the Vatican for the selection process. Among those casting their vote will be Tongan Cardinal Soane Patita Paini Mafi, New Zealander John Dew, and Papua New Guinea's Sir John Ribat. Archbishop Emeritus John Young, formerly of the Mount Hagen Diocese, says Cardinal Ribat's participation in the process is a reflection of the impact and size of PNG's Catholic population.
The Catholic Church has had a big impact for the last 150-plus years in education, health and social services, but also at the political and national level as well. We have the impression that there's an increase. Of course, now at Easter, we have a large number of baptisms, and many of the reports that I'm getting from all over the country is that just about every diocese had an increase in baptisms this year. In my former diocese of Mount Hagen, we always calculated an increase of maybe just a little bit below the rate of population growth. So although we are increasing, we are not increasing at the same rate as the whole population.
How do you think, how much does the Pope resonate with people in Papua?
Well, very clearly from the outpouring of grief that we are seeing in Papua New Guinea, and I mean genuine grief, people crying and being very emotionally affected by news of the death, is an indication of the huge impact that he's had. That was probably true already because of his public statements and concern for the environment and the poor, issues that resonate very much in Papua New Guinea. But certainly after his visit a few months ago, when he came across as very warm and approachable, and yet still quite outspoken on the issues that have marked his pontificate. Care for the environment, addressing some of the issues that we are facing in that regard with forestry and mining, etc., and also a very clear concern for children, for young people, and for those who are otherwise being left out in society. Those people seem to feel that he was their voice, and they appreciated him very much and continue to do so, and therefore were quite grief-stricken when they heard of his passing.
PNG has its first cardinal that will be joining the conclave shortly. How important is it to have cultural diversity at the very top levels of the Catholic Church, like Cardinal Luther?
Well, from the time I was in primary school, we were told the Catholic Church is a Catholic Church, meaning it is universal, meaning that it is everywhere and that it includes all nations and all languages. So that's been our kind of ideology of our identity for centuries. However, it probably wasn't that well manifest at the level of governance. So the last few popes have certainly been trying to address that by making the level of governance much more inclusive, which would include the appointment of cardinals. So we have many cardinals from Africa and Southeast Asia and the Pacific as well. And Pope Francis has been a little bit unusual in this regard. He's often appointed new cardinals from dioceses that were not traditionally places where cardinals came from. And even in some cases, those traditional dioceses sort of didn't get a cardinal under Francis's time in the papacy. So it's certainly quite true that he's made very significant strides. We were hinting at this for some time. You know, how is it that New Zealand, with a much smaller Catholic population than Papua New Guinea, has a cardinal, and we, with a couple of million Catholics, don't seem to get to the same level? So that complaint or query was heard, and we were overjoyed to have a Cardinal Ribart appointed as a cardinal from Papua New Guinea.
That's Archbishop Emeritus John Young, and he was speaking there to the ABC's PNG correspondent Marion Farr. Now, at the Vatican, Pope Francis's body has been lying in state as mourners pay respect ahead of this Saturday's funeral. Across the Pacific, there's been overwhelming sadness at the pontiff's passing. And in the capital of Papua New Guinea, Port Moresby, where Pope Francis visited last September, many are paying tribute to him. The ABC's reporter there, Belinda Cora, has been out on the streets and she's been talking to members of the public.
I love this Pope so much. He's very special to my heart for plenty of reasons, but one reason is that when I went with the bishops in 2023 for the Ad Limina visit, or the visit of the popes, or the bishops, I mean, to the Pope, once in every 5 years, I joined them, Papua New Guinea and Solomon Island bishops. And I was the first woman and a first sister to be able to be given permission by Pope Francis to sit in the audience with all these men. So for me, just the fact that he gave me that opportunity means so much.
During his visit to PNG last year, many were touched or inspired by one of his statements during the youth festival. That was, he asked a question to the youth. His meet with the youth was a dialogue between himself and the youth. So one of the questions he asked was, when someone has fallen, what do you do? And the crowd responded by saying, we help them up.
To me, he showed compassion. That would cover most of what he represented, or how I looked at Pope. Papua New Guinea as a developing country, as a multicultural country, we are going through a lot of challenges. His visit represented unity, not only to Catholics, also to other churches. And what he emphasized, what he always preached, or what he always talked about, he brought all those to PNG. So to me, it was his visit to PNG was very significant.
For me, like a young person like this, but my hate seeing Pope Francis coming to my country, PNG, a poor country, and then visited my place, ECPIC personally, a remote place. For me, it's something significant, and it's like a father who cares for his children.
And those were voices from Papua New Guinea paying tribute to Pope Francis. Now we go to Samoa, where Catholics are remembering the pontiff and his leadership of the Catholic Church. Sister Evelina Tuya of the Missionary Sisters of the Faith, she's a Samoan who's also an Italian citizen, met Pope Francis many times. She told the ABC Samoa reporter Adele Fruin that Pope Francis was a great man and a great leader who has now been called back to God.
And he deserves to go and meet his father in heaven. I'm sure he. I was sad because, you know, we lost a great man of the church. He made a history in the church too. And but at the same time, I said, well, at least he's resting. He's resting, and God knows. Yeah, and I said, oh, Pope, you waited until Easter for you to go? Because, we've been praying for him while he was being hospitalized at Chomeli. And then I said, oh, no, don't tell me. He was going to go. But he didn't let himself go. And he waited until Easter.
She says she hopes the next leader of the church, when it is decided in the Vatican, following the conclave process, will lead like Pope Francis has done over his term.
There were a lot of things that Pope Francis has challenged the church. He challenged the church to go out, you know, to come out from the security of the, you know, each status quo, and take call out to the periphery, call out to the marginalized. You know, so all these things that Pope Francis challenged the church with, I hope and pray that the next leader will come and continue on, not to shift, not to change, you know, but to continue on.
And that was Sister Evelina Tuya of the Missionary Sisters of the Faith. Now, heading over to Timor-Leste, where the Archbishop of Timor-Leste and the government have announced a mass in Dili on Saturday night to honor Pope Francis. It'll be around the same time as the Pope's funeral at St. Peter's Square at the Vatican. The Timor mass will be held at Tasitolu, the site where an estimated 600,000 people came together to participate in the mass when Pope Francis visited last year. For this event, a huge crowd is also expected to gather. Other parishioners around Timor-Leste have been advised to hold mass around the same day and night in honor of the Pope. And just a note that the Pope's funeral will be broadcasted here on ABC Radio Australia at 5:30 Papua New Guinea time on Saturday.
The Pacific. It's our home and what connects us all.
Thousands of islands, all with a unique story to tell.
Hi, I'm Alice Lolo here.
And I'm Johnson Ryder.
Join us every week to watch The Pacific.
And hear from dedicated journalists throughout the region bringing those stories home to you.
All the latest from the places we love.
The Pacific.
Because what matters here matters everywhere.
Watch Thursdays on ABC Australia.
Definitely tune in to The Pacific, which will be on tonight on ABC Australia. This is Pacific Beat, and I'm Evan Wasuka on this Thursday morning. And coming up in the next 10 minutes of the show, we're going to meet the Samoan man who's been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Lelaulu is a development entrepreneur. He's based in Washington, D.C., and he's worked in the international space for several decades now. And despite being away from the islands, he hasn't quite lost his sense of humor.
But I still thought it was a prank. I thought it was a joke. And then he kept saying, no, it's not. And he was serious. And so that was a bit of a surprise. And it was amazing. It was just overwhelming. I still thought it was a joke for a couple of days later.
We'll have more on that chat with Nobel Prize nominee, Lele Lelaulu. You're listening to Pacific Beat. The number of mother-to-child HIV cases are on the rise in Fiji, with more than 20 cases recorded last year. It comes as Fiji health authorities recorded more than 1,000 cases last year, three times more than 2023, and a ninefold increase on the number recorded in 2019. To help the situation, the World Health Organization, UNICEF, and UNAIDS have launched a five-year roadmap to guide Asia-Pacific countries towards eliminating mother-to-child HIV, syphilis, and hepatitis B transmission. Dr. Rachel Devi is head of the Fiji Family Health Unit and says she's concerned about the increasing rate of infections.
One of the things we've noticed is more than 20 plus children born to HIV through that possible transmission from mother to child. And there's a lot of reasons that could be around it. And one of the main ones could be even moms, coming in late for booking. It could even be associated with HIV transmission during the period of pregnancy. So mother to child transmission in Fiji has increased in the recent few years, and one of the contributing factors could be the injectable drug use transmission that's happening in Fiji as well. So because if, for example, a partner is practicing injectable drug use while the woman's pregnant, and that transmits to the partner, the woman, obviously we know there's opportunity, a huge opportunity of transmission to the child, even during breastfeeding when they've delivered.
How big of an issue is this in Fiji?
We have seen an increase in numbers. Like I mentioned, we had, I believe, in 2022 or so, we've seen 12, 13, 14 cases. And in the last year, we've seen more than 20 plus babies born with HIV. And these are all mother-to-child transmissions. And we can pick them up as early as a few months to about a year or two. And we're seeing that right now. And unfortunately, some of these babies end up quite sick in intensive care admissions where we test them for HIV and they come out turn out positive for HIV and sometimes even co-infected with TB as well. So it is concerning for us, and that being it's an important area that we're trying to explore as to why, what exactly are we missing out on? Where are we missing out on with these women?
A roadmap has been launched by the World Health Organization, UNICEF, and UNAIDS. What does it hope to help with?
Thanks, Lucy. This roadmap that's been just recently launched is, I must say, it's very timely as well. I mean, in the sense that we in Fiji are also developing our elimination to mother-to-child transmission. And it's, I must say, it's not just HIV. We are looking a lot broader than HIV. It's looking at HIV, syphilis, and hepatitis B. It's a triple elimination context. While it's global targets and we're looking at it from a national context as well, it's basically, it's just a roadmap that helps the countries guide that we do work in a systematic manner, like from a health systems approach, to make sure we're covering all aspects of care for, elimination of mother-to-child transmission of not just HIV, but syphilis and hepatitis B. This is a space where we're literally working on. And as we speak, Fiji has, we had sought a consultant through UNICEF. So we are developing our elimination of mother-to-child transmission action strategic plan as well.
What are the challenges that need to be overcome in these next few years as we work to hopefully towards elimination?
There's challenges at different levels, and one of the largest challenges would be, for example, is our decentralization of care. while we know we have decentralized, we've got decentralized care for hepatitis B and syphilis, we know that HIV is not totally decentralized. So one challenge we immediately faced with is decentralizing HIV across the divisions in all our health facilities that are delivering. And that is something that we're working on, because without decentralization of this HIV care to our various hospitals across the nation, not just the tertiary care hospitals, but even the subdivisional hospitals, making sure that they're able to care and deliver our moms who are HIV positive as well. So that will be one of our challenges in making sure it's decentralized. And then at the same time, being able to provide point of care testing, not just screening, but also confirmation on site in a decentralized manner. Because the moment we are able to overcome this particular challenge and making sure that service delivery is available right at that lower level in the district, sub-district areas in Fiji, in the subdivisional hospitals, we're able to provide care in a lot more efficient manner.
That's Dr. Rachel Devi, head of the Fiji Family Health Unit, and she was speaking there to the ABC's Lucy Cooper. You're listening to Pacific Beat. I'm Evan Wasuka here with you on this Thursday morning. And from journalism to renewable energy, tourism, food security and climate change, Lele Le Laulu appears to have done it all in his long career. Now, the Samoan development entrepreneur is reported to be among this year's nominees for the Nobel Peace Prize. He's among 338 candidates who've been nominated for the prestigious prize, with the winner to be announced in October. The ABC's Final for Nua caught up with a very busy Lele Le Laulu.
Could you describe the moment you found out you were a nominee? Like, where were you and how did you find out?
I got a telephone call. I was in Washington, D.C., and I got a telephone call from one of the nominators, which is part of a non-governmental organization affiliated with the United Nations in New York. And I knew, but I still thought it was a prank. I thought it was a joke. And then he kept saying, no, it's not. And he was serious. And so that was a bit of a surprise. And it was amazing. It was just overwhelming. I still thought it was a joke for a couple of days later. But then when the citations were written and shown, it was clear that they were serious. So then it became very serious. And, there's just surprise and just a bit of, overwhelming sensation. And it's still hard to believe at this point in time. And I'll have to wait until October the 10th when the Nobel Committee in Oslo, Norway, announces the laureate. So it's going to be interesting. But, there are a lot of people. There are 338 candidates, organizations and individuals have been nominated. So a lot of people out there. So I'm just happy to be part of the crowd.
And why were you nominated?
I have no idea, but I think that largely because of work. I did a lot of development work, in the poorer countries of the world, and essentially I highlighted the fact that, peace is only possible when there's no poverty. And so we have to get rid of poverty if we're going to have a real chance of getting, durable peace. So most of my work is centered on that. It has been non-profit, non-governmental organizations, and in Africa, Asia, the Pacific, of course, and South American places. And I actually did a lot of work with the Australian government, with Australian Aid, on the Pacific Leadership Program, which was led by Cameron Bowles and Georgina Cope. And this was quite useful too, because what it did was it trained the leaders in ensuring that their communities remain strong. And if communities are strong, then they can deal with conflict and therefore there'll be peace. So lots of work like that in different parts of the world. Also working, helping the Mayan Indians in Central America, Guatemala, Honduras, and Salvador. Get them sort of reassociated with the heritage, and then looking at traditional ways of making peace. and this sort of stuff. And also I did a lot of humanitarian work, carrying aid to different parts of the world in the former Soviet Union. And then also I think I got a lot of notice when I arranged for the evacuation of Ethiopian Jews to Israel with the help of the Ethiopian government, thank goodness. And little, you know, things like that, they all add up. And then people just nominate you. And, you know, there are different organizations that can nominate. I mean, I can nominate my dog if I wanted to, but it will not be accepted by the Norwegian authorities. And so different organizations like human rights organizations, cabinet ministers and different governments and human rights organizations and former Nobel laureates can put up names. So, yeah, that's how it's done. And I'm just glad that I'm part of the lineup of the people that may be selected.
Do you feel proud representing the Pacific? I mean, of course, you must feel proud, but how does it feel to be a Pacific Islander role model? Because you are a role model, whether you like it or not.
Thanks, you know. well, Tony DeBroom, the late Tony DeBroom, he was a mate of mine. So I have great respect for him and I liked him a lot. And also the fact that Tony DeBroom was, a couple of other Pacific leaders, they were responsible for getting the Paris Accords approved by, you know, all the major countries of the world. So it was a massive achievement. So Tony's fantastic. Tuvalu, the Prime Minister of Tuvalu and other countries were also extremely effective international diplomats. And it just goes to prove what I've been saying along, that, you know, the quality of the advice does not depend on the size of the advice giver. So there, you know, all these leaders from very, very small countries actually showing the way to agreement and peace to the world's largest and most powerful country. So that's what we Pacific Islanders from our small countries and communities can do. We can show people ways of dealing with global issues, and we're good at that.
You described yourself as a development entrepreneur. What does that mean?
Oh, I just couldn't think of another word. Basically, it just means I'm all over the place. But essentially, I look at ways of helping people develop their resources to give themselves lives of dignity and independence and freedom. And so I look at all avenues of doing this. For example, I don't just use the normal anti-poverty things. I look for ways of which are innovative and sort of perhaps not so obvious to use to give people these resources. So, just a bit more entrepreneurial in the way that I get resources for people in need.
That's Nobel Peace Prize nominee Samuan Lele Lelaulu on the line from Washington, D.C. And the reporter there was Finau Funua. And Lele Lelaulu joins the likes of Tony DeBroom from the Marshalls and Simon Coffey from Tuvalu, who have in the past been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Now, there's rugby history in the making in Fiji, now that it's been confirmed officially, that the Drua and their national women's team, Fijiana, will feature in a first-ever doubleheader in Suva on May the 3rd. And for once, it'll be the men providing the curtain raiser when the Drua take on the Queensland Reds in round 12 of the Super Rugby Pacific competition, before the Fijiana take centre stage in their first-ever test match against Australia's Wallaroos on home turf. As Richard Ewitt reports, the Drua and the Fiji Rugby Union plan to use the occasion as a promotional vehicle for developing the women's game.
The Super Rugby TV schedule has worked out rather well for Fijiana because with the early afternoon kickoff time for the Drua cast in stone, it means the women's test against the Wallaroos with its 5 p.m. kickoff will be prime time viewing in Fiji. Fiji Rugby Women's High Performance Manager Alana Thomas says the match will be Fijiana's 12th home test and there are plans for three more later in the year.
this test is another momentous occasion. We've seen the success of the Fijian Dura women's doubleheader in Suva with the Western Force semi-final in 2024, and this time now with the Reds playing the men's game and the women's test match at 5 o'clock after the men's game. I think it's going to be an opportunity to see two teams going to the Rugby World Cup in England, wanting to start their campaign strong. Both teams are looking to build their squad's depth and start their year off really strong. It's the first time the Wallaroos have been to Fiji as a national test team. We've been there the last 3 years. Now we want to welcome them to our shores, and you know, we're just really excited.
The Andrews General Commercial Manager Shane Hussain says ticket prices will be the same as for a single match, so they're offering a 2-for-1 deal starting at $25. The players will be out and about in the week prior to the game to meet and greet fans and promote the big event. And the hope is the timing of the games will be perfect for attracting girls and young women in particular to get a taste of big-time rugby.
To have a international quality test with our first campaign for the season for both the national sides of Fiji and Australia makes it even more important, even more special. It's school holidays starting next weekend. It's a great time to bring the kids along, a great time to bring your girls along to showcase the future of women's rugby in Fiji.
Fijiana have already begun their match preparations in Singatoka before switching to Suva next week. Alana Thomas says her coaches are keen for her players to learn lessons from past test matches and from the Super Rugby season just ended.
The teams that can get the ascendancy in that breakdown and contact area are the teams that can really do some damage in attack and also defence. So I think there's going to be a big emphasis on that contact area coming into the test match next week and trying to really build on the work that's been done from Super Rugby into this test match. And these players have all been in a great program for the last few months and wanting to take it up a level as we go into this test.
As part of their World Cup build-up, Fijiana will also be taking on Tonga and Samoa later in the year, and more home tests are considered to be vital in the push to develop the women's game in Fiji.
The more that we can get Fijiana out there playing, and for young girls who are playing, whether they're getting into rugby, whether they're playing Kanji rugby, whether they're playing provincial rugby, we want those girls to be able to watch and see the stars. Our sevens are on TV regularly, they're over and playing HSBC, but bringing the game to the shores of Fiji, allowing those young girls to get experience coming and seeing and interacting with us, I think is really important. So looking forward to 2026 and beyond in making some regular tests on Fiji soil.
This is exactly why the Fijian Dura exists, to provide those pathways for the Flying Fijians and the Fijiana teams to prepare players for top quality international rugby. And so we're very proud to be playing a part in this process. So I, for one, I know, and I know my team will be very excited after we finish with the men's game to get up on the stand or get up on the grass and watch a cheer for our Fijiana team.
The Andrews match against the Reds is one they must win to keep their Super Rugby finals hopes alive. So a big crowd is expected. And the hope is they will stick around for the women's test match and give Fijiana a taste of what to expect on the biggest stage of all come August.
I think any time we can share the stage and expose the players to the crowds that we'll have at the men's game and then staying around for the women's game, that's what we're going to be experiencing come Rugby World Cup time. And that's why it's really important for us to be playing this game as a doubleheader, to allow the players that experience of a big crowd, the noise, the excitement, the build up to it, because the Rugby World Cup at the end of this year is going to be the biggest in the history of women's rugby. It's going to take the game to a new level, and we need to expose these players to more of these occasions.
That's Alana Thomas, Women's High Performance Manager for Fiji Rugby. Looking ahead to the Fijiana showdown with the Wallaroos in Suva on Saturday week, that's part of a doubleheader with the Fijian Drua, and the reporter there was Richard Ewart. You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Evan Wasuka on this Thursday morning. And now to some news that has conservationists very excited. The extremely rare Guam kingfisher has laid their first wild eggs in nearly four decades. 40 years ago, the bird was driven to near extinction by the arrival of the brown tree snakes in Guam. But scientists were able to breed a few of the remaining birds in a U.S. zoo in Kansas before releasing them last year on an isolated atoll. And joining me this morning is bird conservation scientist Caitlin Andrews from the Nature Conservancy. Welcome to Pacific Beat, Caitlin.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Caitlin, what was your first reaction when you found out that the eggs had been laid?
Oh, well, when the field team first sent me that very first photo of an egg, it was one of those moments where it's almost like time stood still. So it's this tiny white egg, which is such a simple image, but it really holds so much hope, not only for sea hec, but also for other species on the brink of extinction. And one of the things I love about working on these types of conservation projects is that even though we're working to save a species, we really get to know each individual animal so closely. So while I was celebrating this milestone in the lives of Hinatnau and Tutuhan, the two parents, I was also in awe of just what this moment really means for their species. It's a moment of hope for the population on Palmyra, and it's another major step back home to Guam.
You explained there about the hope it brings to the sea hec, but can you explain how we got to this point and what's gone into this breeding program?
Sure. So sea hec, as you mentioned, became extinct in the wild in Guam due to predation by invasive snakes that drove them to extinction in the 1980s. But before that could happen, some of them were rescued by local biologists and brought into zoos to start a conservation breeding program. And so it's really thanks to that forward-thinking action that sea hec have survived across about 25 zoos around the U.S. and the Guam Department of Agriculture for almost 40 years. But it was really important that we get them back out and living in the wild. And because snakes are still in Guam, we needed a safe place for them. And that's where TNC was really fortunate to be able to offer Palmyra Atoll Preserve as a safe haven for sea hec. And last year, our zoo partners made a massive effort to raise these 9 chicks that then made the journey to Palmyra and were released in September of last year. We call them the first 9, and I'm happy to report that they're still alive and thriving, and we're about 7 months out from that release.
Yeah, and what were some of the challenges in getting those birds to breed in the wild, given that they've been in the zoo the whole time?
Right. So it's definitely, there's so much planning that goes into a conservation translocation like this project. I can't tell you how many times in the last few years I've woken up in the middle of the night thinking, you know, did we think through this detail or that detail? We always hope that the birds will thrive on their own, but we also try to think of all the safeguards we can put in place to support them if needed. So in terms of breeding, we were prepared to step in and provide additional nesting materials if they weren't finding suitable trees, or supplemental food if they weren't finding enough on their own. And we have a field team stationed out on Palmyra keeping close watch on the birds every day. And from day one, the birds clearly signaled that they didn't need our help at all. They immediately started catching geckos and spiders. And it turns out it looks like they're spoiled for choice when it comes to nesting trees.
And With the breeding program, what's the long-term plan? Is the return back to Guam, or what does the future hold for the birds?
Right, so the future, we hope, will look like returning to Guam. That's always been the ultimate goal of this project, and Palmyra is a stepping stone towards that goal. We're trying to learn as much as we can from the birds that we release to Palmyra. We want to start a self-sustaining population out there so we can learn what wild sea hec need to survive and thrive. And we can use this as a testing ground for the strategies that would ultimately be used to bring them home to Guam. And hopefully, if the population thrives, as it's looking like it will, we'll even be able to bring some of those birds that are already adapted to the wild back home to Guam, giving them an even greater chance of success.
And what would that mean for the people of Guam? In what way is this the kingfisher, the sea hec, why is it so important to the people of Guam?
The people of Guam, and especially the indigenous Chamorro community, have a very strong and powerful relationship with their native birds, including the sea hec. So they're woven into oral traditions, and the younger generations, unfortunately, haven't had the chance to grow up seeing birds in their forests. So it's really those older generations that have kept the memory of sea hec alive through the stories they share. So seeing their birds out on Palmyra is hopefully a signal to them that these birds are on their way home. And we're really lucky to work with some amazing partners, including a school teacher in Guam named Melanie Blas, who's also a National Geographic explorer. She's doing some fantastic, inspiring outreach, sea hec themed outreach across Guam schools. And whenever I see any of the artwork or messages from her students, that's the reminder that I need that this is why we're doing what we're doing, so these kids can see sea hec back in their forest someday.
It's great to hear that there's so much attention on this project and the breeding program. Coming back to the birds and their eggs. How many eggs were laid, and what are you expecting in terms of how many birds will come out of this process?
Right, so it's still early days. We have 9 birds on Palmyra. Again, that's how many we released. They're all still alive. And so 4 pairs have formed, and at least 3 of them have laid eggs so far. It's still pretty early for these birds to successfully hatch chicks. They're still very young themselves. So it might be at least a couple months until they're old enough to do that. But this first attempt is a really great sign that they see Palmyra as a safe place and a good home. And we hope that with this practice, they will hatch chicks soon and will welcome the first generation of wild-born Palmyra sea hec.
Mm. And you mentioned that you have a team there on the atoll. How many people are we talking about, and what does their day-to-day activities look like?
So our field team has a core crew of 2 people. Kayla Baker and Johnny Shepherd are our 2 bird conservation specialists. So they're based out at Palmyra, essentially full-time, and we have a rotation of partners who come fill in some gaps and provide extra support throughout the year. And they are out early in the morning following these birds, keeping an eye on them, recording as much detail as they can about their behavior and these nesting attempts, again, to gather as much knowledge as we can about what these first wild sea heck in almost 40 years look like and what support they need from us to thrive, which so far is not much support. They're doing it on their own. But having a staff on site is really important so that we're ready to help support them if needed to ensure their success.
Now, Caitlin, before I let you go, it's really good to hear that the Guam kingfisher and the sea heck are thriving. But for our listeners out there, if they want to find out more about the Guam kingfisher and the sea heck, where can they go to get more information?
Well, I highly recommend, and I'll put in a plug for our Instagram. The handle is CHEC_recovery_project. We try to keep that full of photos and videos from the field, and you can see what the day-to-day looks like for our field team. They put out some great content, and we will keep everyone posted as these birds continue to settle in at Palmyra.
Caitlin, really good to have you on the show. Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And that was Caitlin Andrews from the Nature Conservancy. She was speaking to me there about the breeding program involving the Guam kingfisher and the sea heck. Thank you for listening. This is Pacific Beat. You've been listening to Pacific Beat. I'm Evan Wasuka on this Thursday morning. Thank you for your company. And you can join us on the afternoon show with Liam Fox. That's coming up at 5 o'clock Papua New Guinea time. Thank you for your company on ABC Radio Australia. Coming up next is Nature Daily with Michael Chow. And you can stay tuned with that, because right next up next is the ABC News Bulletin.